meeting, it's time to start. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you and welcome. We have a full house today. It's great to see so many of you here. Thank you for taking time. I know how busy you are, and we very much appreciate it. We would also like to welcome Bishop Burton. Thank you. As the advisory committee chair, we'll go ahead and get started with the agenda. We do have a new commission member. Unfortunately, she's going to be joining us just a little bit late, so we'll welcome Nina when she comes. So we'll go ahead then. You should have minutes from the April 13th meeting in front of you. And hopefully you've had a chance to review those. We'll entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
So move.
Motion is a second.
Seconded.
Thank you. Dr. Minor, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Okay, item number two on the agenda is the appointment of juvenile court judge Scott Davis. His name was submitted by the juvenile courts to fill the vacancy. As you guys, I think everybody knows, Judge Lyman is no longer with us, and so we're very excited. Your name has been submitted, Judge. Thank you.
Thank you
for joining us. We're excited to have you. It's recommended that Judge Davis is appointed to the Intergenerational Poverty Committee, and I think we do need a motion to approve that, correct? I would look for a motion to approve that. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. And welcome. Would you like to give a speech?
Or no.
We're really excited to have you. Why don't you just tell everybody a little bit about your background?
Sure.
Yeah, we'd appreciate that.
I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska. Moved down to Utah. I grew up there. Lived there for 40 years. Moved down to Utah in 2000, July of 2000, and have worked almost all my career in child welfare and juvenile delinquency, and was appointed to the bench just a little over a year ago.
Thank you. We're excited to have you. All right. Let's go ahead now into item number three, findings of state agencies in our studies. As you all know, we've talked about this in here. We asked our agencies to go back and look at that initial cohort from the year 2013 when the legislature and many of these people first started working on intergenerational poverty. So that first cohort. And analyze what they were able to find by looking at what's happened to that group over the past five, now 6 years, and look at findings, recommendations, anything else we need to know, kind of where we're headed and next steps. So we'll go ahead and start there. Do you want to start down? Okay.
So I'll ask Colin to come up and things. Kathy, or
yes.
Martinez to come up and do the DWS overview or report out on what we've learned. So come on up. Stand up. Wherever you'd like to do. Yeah.
Okay, sure. So our report from DWS summarizes the available education and workforce data on the 2012 cohort. So some high level findings that are in the report are that in general, the cohort originally consisted of about 30,000 individuals, and since 2012, the number has been increasing, so the people are moving out of the ICP cohort. The cohort was mostly female, so about 67% female and 32% male. Same for the ICP children cohort, that was about half and half, and there were 44,000 individuals in 2012, and that has also been decreasing from 2012 to 2013. The average and median wages of the cohort has increased since 2012. So has the number of individuals employed for four quarters of the year has increased from 28% to 35% over the years. And we also looked at correlates of IGP, so we were looking at which demographic, educational, and workforce predictors were correlated with experiencing IGP. And in general, we found that the more months an individual spends on public assistance as a child, the more likely they are to continue experiencing IGP. I mentioned, the cohort was mostly female. We found that having a college education at the associate's or bachelor's level decreased the probability of experiencing ITP. Conversely, having less than high school level education increased the probability of experiencing ITP. And lastly, being Native American also increased the probability of experiencing ITP. Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Any questions? Any additional thoughts?
Kelsey, did anything stand out in the data that surprised you? Maybe different than what you expected?
We were really interested by the fact that the number of people working four quarters has increased. I guess that could be partially due to economic recovery post-2008. But in general, the outlook has been good for the 2013 cohort. So.
The number of the cohort was 30,000 roughly?
About 30,000, yep.
And in 12, what is it? What was it in 17?
23,000.
I'd like to hear those numbers. I think you all should take credit.
Was there a decrease in the number of children from the original?
Yeah, so those were started at about 44,000 and it's now at 25,000, but that could also be due to people reaching age 18. But most of the cohort is about from age 0 to 10, so also some people moving on.
Any evaluation on the rate of pay they're achieving? Have we dug into their wage records or anything like that?
So the average wage in 2012 was about 5,200, and that's increased to 7,400. The median is a lot lower. There's a lot of people that earn zero wages, so it's about 800 in 2012 and 1,200 in 2017. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? All right, I'd like to hear that. Thank you. Okay. Department of Health.
Yes. Brantley Scott is going to present for us on our healthcare profile utilization. Sterling and Representative Thurston from that office who got help with this are also here.
It was the 2012 cohort, and so the first year we had was 2013, so 2013 sort of starting place to see if anything jumps out about these people in comparison to the other cohort that's not in the germination month. And at a high level, what we found is those who suffer from intergenerational poverty, they have higher health risk scores, higher healthcare costs, and poor health in general. And I'm a little bit of a data guy, so I'm going to get into some graphs and some numbers. So hopefully it makes sense. I've tried to consolidate them. But if you guys have any questions, just let me know as we go along. So the first thing I did is I just did a little bit of, once we've had the data linked, what is the basic demographics of this population? So I broke it down to age, gender, classifications. And one of the interesting things I found, I was trying to compare these two groups, but can anyone see something a little bit different about these two groups right off the bat? I've got some arrows pointing. So the intergenerational poverty group, almost all of them, a majority of them come from the 0 to 21 years, while the comparison group has basically not no one there. So that presented a challenge for us as we tried to compare these groups. And so in order to make them comparable, what I did is the rest of this analysis that I'll present today just focuses on those adult populations, 22 and over, broken into the male, female, category classifications. So one of the things that we look at is risk. And so we use the Milliman CRG risk score calculation. So CRG stands for clinical risk grouping. And it's indexed at, or its average is 1. So looking at this at a high level, you can see if you have a risk score of 2, which is the intergenerational female group, it's almost double the average risk. It's a very risky health grouping classification. And following that was the intergenerational male grouping with a little bit more than 1.5 in the female comparison, and the male comparison followed with slightly less risk. And then we also saw the median and PMPM, which is per member per month cost. And so you can see it follows a similar trend, but even more extreme, that these intergenerational poverty females have a much higher healthcare cost than the comparison group. And the males as well have a much higher cost than the comparison group. And so I wanted to dig into what is causing this? What's causing this higher risk and higher cost? And so what we have here is we have the top 10 CRGs classifications, and we have, this doesn't have a pointer, does it? Yeah, it is. Okay. So we have, this is the comparison group of the non-intergenerational poverty, and we have the intergenerational poverty here. And there's a lot of interesting things we can dive into. I just love this data and all the stuff we can do with it. But I wanted to look at just, four different classifications. And so what we see is that the healthy and the non-users are much lower for the intergenerational poverty group than the comparison group. So in general, they're not being classified as healthy, and they're not being classified as not using the healthcare system. And then for this female group, the next two classification is delivery without complications and without significant illnesses, and delivery with complications and with significant illness. And so, again, it's sort of a pretty clear picture here that those who aren't in intergenerational poverty, they're more likely to not have these complicated deliveries, while the intergenerational poverty group is less likely to be healthy, and it's more likely to have both complications and illness. And you can see those other classifications here as well. Will be the intergenerational poverty, which is more likely to have either complications or significant illness. And an interesting thing to point out is, remember the high risk score of 2? This has got a risk score of 6, which is like 6 times as risky, and potentially 6 times as costly. So if we can get these people going from the 6-risk score to a 3-risk score, that would be a huge benefit. And then I looked at the male population. It wasn't quite as interesting, but again, you sort of see that the healthy population and the non-users were lower for the intergenerational poverty in comparison to the comparison group. The other interesting thing that stood out is schizophrenia. I wasn't expecting that, actually. And you can see that the intergenerational poverty group is 5%, which is fairly high percentage in comparison to the non-intergenerational poverty, which is only 0.7. You can see here schizophrenia was better in the moderate chronic disease. And you also see that they have depression and major mental illness. The fairly comparable, it's a little bit higher here. And so what we're finding is that these people who suffer from intergenerational poverty, they also have mental illness issues that they're struggling with. And so just to wrap up, if I'm not running up too much time, this is in case you, this is just a summary. You know, we found that intergenerational poverty groups and higher healthcare needs and costs, specifically the adult female population and maternity came to the top for both of these groups. That's an area that we can focus on. And the mental health issues, I think for all the populations, the female group did have depression that showed up, and they, you know, I didn't dive into this, and that's actually one of the things that we can do a little bit further is break down those health classifications. It lists the other significant illness, and that could be mental illness. And so those, my assumption is that there's mental health issues for both the male and the female population, but due to the delivery classification, it was a stronger classification, so the mental health issues didn't show up quite as clearly. And so some of the areas of future research, one of the things that I'd like to do is look more at the pediatric population. I did a little bit of digging there, and the 2018 cohort is actually a lot more comparable, so we can do a better comparison with that cohort. I did a little bit of look at the longitudinal study of both the health and the cost. It was a little bit messy due to the fact that if you have a delivery, it's going to be a high cost one year and less so the next year. So it was not as much stability in that. So maybe I could look at, you know, individuals who didn't have a delivery or didn't have high health needs. One of the other issues that we know at the Department of Health is the place of service impacts a lot how much things cost and also the quality of care that you're receiving. And we did look at that, and that's an area that we could future study to see if the intergenerational poverty is maybe having unnecessary ER visits or not receiving the treatment at a primary care physician. And then, as I mentioned, breaking down those health classifications a little bit more to get a better idea of what's happening with the population. And that's my presentation. Do you guys have any questions? Yeah?
When you looked at the cost for females with high risk, it was $800, and that was compared to women, that was $400. That was a comparison group.
Yeah.
Is that per individual, per month? How does that cost add up with the population? Do you have an estimate for
like the general population?
Yeah, like thousands of dollars.
Yeah, so in general, a healthy person would be about $300, give or take, you know, $100. That's very broad, but that's sort of about what we expect. Is about $300, which,
So if there's, let's say, 15,000 females that are IEP, that's 15,000 times $500
per month.
12.
Yeah, so if you times this by 12, it gets to be very large numbers fairly quickly. And I recently had my wife had a baby, I didn't have a baby. But it's expensive, and she had a normal vaginal delivery, and I can only imagine if there were complications, if they can't stay in the queue for a few days, it can really back up costs. And not only that, but there's more emotional turmoil that goes into that.
So millions of dollars per year.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Yeah. points out the importance that most of our county plans have include some addressing of behavioral health, mental health, and substance use disorders. Those definitely are overrepresented in the intergenerational poverty cohort.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Anyone else? Thank you. Interesting. Especially on the gender side. It would be interesting to isolate, again, to take out the problems with babies and delivery and see if there are still health disparities. I'd be interested in seeing them. Okay. Thank you. Who we have next? Department of Human Services.
Thank you, Rick Little. Fantastic.
Thank you. We have a handout. I didn't prepare slides. I wasn't sure if slides would be an option today. My name is Rick Little. I am the director of our Management Information Center at the Department of Human Services. We oversee analysis and research within the agency, and what we're handing out is the work of a lot of people. My participation was really a bit more at arm's length on this, and so naturally, I'm the one to present it. As this handout comes around, I'll just let you know this. We appreciate the opportunity, really, to be able to participate in the Intergenerational Poverty Report, to be invited to make observations and then to share this information with you. At Human Services, there were three program areas that were evaluated for matching with the IGP population. That includes the juvenile justice system, the public behavioral health system, and the child welfare system. And I thought I would, you tell me what's best. I can cover all three at once and then save the questions to the end for all three, or should we break them up one at a time? Good, I'm just gonna go through it.
Okay, high points, pause, see if there's questions, carry on.
Very good. All right. Again, our understanding is that the IGP cohort was defined by those who were attached to public assistance extending back into the late 1980s. And as a consequence of that, we found that some of the matching may have limited or omitted older people, seniors and others, perhaps those who didn't have families. That's just a caveat because throughout we found in some instances lower matching rates than we would have expected. Juvenile justice. Utah's juvenile justice system is a collection of public and private agencies that serve juveniles charged with violations of the law. Juvenile court probation and the Division of Juvenile Justice Services are two of the system's lead agencies. In general, probation provides supervision and other services to youthful offenders who remain in their homes. JJS provides residential care and rehabilitative services for the most serious delinquent youth who require removal from their homes for extended periods. In general, JJS provides a variety of preventative and rehabilitative services for youth in early stages of delinquency. Services are arranged and delivered directly by two agencies from a continuum of care that allows Utah juvenile court judges to make graduated responses to youth in proportion to the severity of their behavior and their needs for services. There, I read that because JJS would be very happy that I did that. Summary of our findings. Individuals studied were members of, we refer to it as the 2013 cohort, but they're participants from 2012. So sometimes we'll refer to the 2012 cohort. These are, we studied those who reached the age of 12 between July 1st of 2011 and June 30th of 2012. That's our IGP youth cohort. These youth were followed through their 18th birthdays. There were 1,561 of these 12-year-olds. Results for the group were then compared with results for other Utah youth who turned 12 years of age during that same period but were not members of the IGP cohort. Results reveal, I'm sorry I'm kind of reading this, but you've got, all got this in front of you, I thought you'd like to keep it. Results reveal that juvenile justice is a prominent feature in the lives of many of these youth and their families. A striking 50% of youth from the IGP cohort experienced contact with Utah's juvenile justice system by their 18th birthday. In general, IGP youth were much more likely than non-IGP youth to have contact with Utah's juvenile justice system. They were more often female, Native American, or Hispanic. They were more often to be charged with a serious offense. And they were more likely than non-IGP youth to have received a disposition placing them in state custody or on probation. In other words, their sentences tended to be more severe. And they were more likely than non-IGP youth to have received a delinquency risk assessment that indicated a higher risk to reoffend. Our observation is that JJS using these findings to explore options, particularly in its youth services programs, to better support IGP youth and their families. As part of this effort, we would like to establish regional contacts with DWS to help determine the IGP status of youths entering JJS services. An important next step would be for us to look more closely at the risk factors associated with IGP youth to determine unique needs that they may have and determine how responsive those are to traditional interventions. So I'll pause there and ask if there are any questions about our juvenile justice. Yeah, Ben?
Isn't there a robust tradition of peer courts to avoid the juvenile system? How does that play into this? And my second thought question, what is the baseline for the non-IGP youth? I know it's not 50%.
Yeah, that was my question.
Is it 5%, 1%?
I'm sorry, I want to handle each of those questions. Let's do the first one first.
Do the first, yeah. Peer courts.
The peer courts there, now, Anne, you probably...
Sure, I'm happy to jump in. So, if I may.
Yeah, please.
And I appreciate you lifting it and using the word robust. I don't know what robust means, because I would say I don't believe that they're a level lifted. I think as we'd like them to be, they're a piece of juvenile justice reform we try to encourage. The more if anyone's with me and superintendent, so certainly speak up. But I don't know that they're as prolific as some research evidence would tell us we'd like to see relative to diverting you from the more formal. And I'd look to you, Judge, to please speak up if you think
right.
I'm misrepresenting the accuracy. I think in our more metropolitan areas of the state, they exist, but I don't know that we have them as readily resourced as we'd like in the more rural areas of the state. This does underlie, though, the import of our long-term commitment and our consistent and steady commitment to juvenile justice reform writ large, meaning how intentionally we get in early to identify potential risks that don't have anything to do with a pipeline into a justice setting, but rather shore up the factors of protection and safety and security in the young people's lives earlier on. Yes,
and I think to Ben's question, it will be interesting a couple years down the road as we see some of these rural and remote places kind of enlarging their sphere of influence around juvenile justice, where they're starting to really understand how to link with community outreach and the structure that's been put forth in the reform. Juab County is a great example where they've been doing this for a number of years of bringing the court system, mental health, everybody that's here around the table, basically the police force in that county and the school system. And at times they'll take turns convening everyone. Superintendent Robbins of Juab District has been the convener for a couple of years, and they come monthly to talk about students that are in juvenile, in the court system, or in the incarcerated or in trouble. And it's a family conversation that they have. So they look at what resources are they accessing from DHS, from DWS, where's the intervention, drug issues, whatever it is, they don't just say this student is acting out in school or having behavior issues in school. They really look at the family problem. And so that was built in, I think, to the model reform. So I'll be really interested to see how these numbers change over time as rural districts, which said we just don't have resources, now have better resources and ways to think about connecting with regional offices to help mitigate the in-school and out-of-school problems.
Thank you.
We're also hoping, Ben, that one of the governor's priorities this past legislative session and it was to get more funding into schools for counseling and trying to get upstream of these behavior issues as much as possible. And so we know that we'll have significant increases in staffing this year in school districts that will hopefully help to mitigate some of those.
Such a high number.
It's a huge number. I mean, I had no idea it was that high.
Now, I would like to point out, that includes our early intervention services, and some of those are very light touch and in the schools. And so that, 50% is suggesting that all of those kids are in custody.
Oh, okay, right.
Okay, so that's all juvenile justice services. I believe the report does break out the custody and non-custody youth in that number, but in terms of touch points with juvenile justice overall, the number's pretty high. But the number, and in some communities, the number is as the comparable number. I think the question that you asked, Ben, was how does that compare with the others? And those numbers range right around 20%, depending on the community. But again, that includes the early intervention services. Okay?
It's still more than double.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's a big number. It truly is.
I have one other question. This maybe is for Ann. On number three, it says more serious offenses. Can you describe, or maybe the judge can describe, what are considered more serious offenses for...
Thank you. I would defer since
they're
before you all.
Well, they could include assaults, violence offenses, more serious drug offenses. It seems that we have a high level of marijuana abuse among all demographic groups. But I would think that the statistics would likely show that IGP cohort has a higher incident of more serious substance abuse issues. This one is, I struggle to think that rates of sexual offenses are higher among IGP kids than they are non-IGP, because I see an awful lot of them among all demographics.
I'd be happy to follow up with some data, because we are tracking Class A, right, Judge?
Yes.
Correct me, I'm not the lawyer of the training, but we do have the classifications of the charges relative to, we can distinguish.
Yeah, interesting.
I agree with you. That's a general term, and let's get you some data. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So, substance abuse and mental health. All right. The Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health, DSAMH. Is the state's public assistance authority, public substance. That was a long time in DWS.
Yeah, I was going to say,
it was a long time in DWS. Public Substance Abuse and Mental Health Authority. DSAMH contracts with local county governments, statutorily designated as local substance abuse and mental health authorities. By statute, DSAMH focuses on prevention, early identification, and intervention as steps to avoid or mitigate future behavioral risks. As the public behavioral health system is largely funded by Medicaid, low-income clients benefit from the removal of cost barriers to treatment and services. Accordingly, low-income and or Medicaid clients represent a large portion of those in Utah's public behavioral health system. So our findings. The total Utah population in need of and served by behavioral health care is not captured entirely within the public behavioral health system. Many individuals have private insurers and providers and alternate options for mental health and substance abuse treatments. The public behavioral health system functions as a safety net for low-income individuals and families. Nearly 90% of those in the public behavioral health system are low-income, as defined by the guidelines in the IGP report. So this is primarily a system for those who are already in poverty. Most are eligible for Medicaid. The estimated number of Utahns in 2012 living in poverty was about 365,000. That same year, Utah the public behavioral health database contained records for 56,824 Utahns, of which 90% were low income. This represents approximately 14% of all Utahns living in poverty in 2012. Among the IGP cohort, and we compared adults and children, 75,000, 9.9% were matched with the public behavioral health database. This percentage seems low as compared to the total number of those in poverty and with some of the comments that were made earlier. However, the IGP cohort includes records only for those with public assistance payments back to 1987. A large number of people in that database are seniors. So I think that if we had a more full picture of all of those who are IGP, extending back, say, before the 1980s, we would have seen this number come up quite a bit from what we were able to match. But we're only able to match the information that's available to us, and this is what we were able to find. Generally, the public behavioral health system serves low-income individuals. Finding differences between the IGP cohort and others in the public behavioral health data is challenging because they share many of the same characteristics of the point of observation. They're almost all of them in poverty. And so there aren't very many distinguishing characteristics between the Medicaid mental health clients and the IGP population use the public behavioral health system similarly. They have comparable services, and they have exactly the same median duration of time in services. And in the report, it breaks those out and shows you what those durations are. So as mandated by federal requirements, DSAMH estimates the need for behavioral health services in Utah using national and local data. The gap between these estimates and the actual number of people served suggests that there is a lack of access to behavioral health services for some people, including low-income individuals and families. Within the small match data review, there is no evidence that the IGP population has increased participation in mental health and substance use services than the general poverty population in Utah. So it may very well be that the comments made earlier about the IGP population and an increased level of participation, say in mental health services, is reflective of all individuals in poverty, not just the IGP population. We couldn't find a substantial difference between the IGP group and others in poverty that are part of that public behavioral health system. Future research could evaluate if low-income, evaluate if low-income and or IGP populations have appropriate access and utilization of behavioral health services based on Medicaid or other health care coverage factors. Questions on substance abuse and mental health? Great, moving on. I'm kind of kidding.
I just think this reveals stigma and hurdles that sometimes we put in front of ourselves by the notion of what does it mean to say I need behavioral health services. Further dialogue around trauma in a minute, but I mean, I think, Tracy, when I think about Lieutenant Governor, when you traveled the state, we launched a John IGP from county to county to county, right, regionally. I just remember already in those rooms, the discussion being fundamentally, why does there seem to be a disconnect between the prevalence of what we well know through the lives that we know are individuals suffering with unaddressed mental health needs and unaddressed substance use disorder treatment needs, and yet the numbers are so low, they just don't seem to match. Why aren't they connecting to the service? What is the hurdle between pain and suffering and needs for care and accessing the care? And that continues to... any other voices? I don't want to over-talk.
No, you're good. And I think you're expressing the feelings of the group. So, thank you.
Thanks, Redman.
What would be a reasonable number of participation that you think would be a good target?
Well, are you asking that question in the context of just among those in poverty?
Well, it sounds like poverty and IGP are hard to distinguish in terms of use.
In terms of this data, it's hard to distinguish.
Yeah, and so maybe it's a win if either group, regardless of if you're able to determine which participates in these programs. I'm just curious if there's a capacity question of how many more could use services, what's reasonable movement of the needle in terms of percentage. I know that might be difficult to answer, but I'm curious.
I think that's what the federal government is trying to get at in part with this idea. It's almost like a participation rate. They say, well, what's the demand or the need out there? Now, that demand and need, though, but according to the feds, is not it's not distinguished based on economic strata. It's not a question of poverty. It's more a question of mental health in the community, and there is a gap. It would be interesting to understand what that gap looks like for those in poverty, and we don't know it right now.
And I don't know, Dr. Meyer, if there are metrics. I'd be curious if they're similarly, someone suffering with diabetes. What do we hope is a good target for accessing physical health care if you're suffering with a physical health need? And I don't know what our target, but we begin to imagine our target to be. Because how do we accept, I don't know what would be an acceptable rate below?
And we know that this is an issue outside of these cohorts, within the middle class population.
Right.
We know that access to service is a problem. We certainly have a shortage. Go to many of our So we definitely see that. That's one of the projects working with the guy down at Dixie State on how do we get more mental health professionals into the system. There's a shortage there for sure. And I can only imagine it's got to be worse the less you can afford, right? Harder. So.
One suggestion we had in the University of Utah at a medical school is looking at this, is training better primary care physicians to address the mental health and substance use issues that the patient they're seeing are having, to be more, feel more confident and competent to address those in their primary care setting.
And there's some easy ways to do that. We get some pushback from doctors on occasion. So
oh, yeah. Well,
it's yeah.
They see it so often that they really do need to be able to at least do the entry level type of services while they're waiting for more expert care somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. And this goes into suicide rates.
Absolutely.
Issues.
I know this is one of the things that the Alliance is trying to work in Washington County and Beaver County as
right.
well, is social determinants of health, because it seems that the emergency room is where we're treating, and that means that we weren't getting care prior to that time. So we do need to do a better job of breaking down silos. We do recognize that culturally, families that are struggling with poverty, there's not a tendency usually to take your health serious until you're in crisis and need to call an ambulance because you're in some sort of real critical need. And so I think we're going to continue to have to grapple with this. But I think anything we can do as a state agencies and working with physical and mental health to bridge those, I do think that IHC is doing a lot of great work in trying to figure that out. We should try to support them. I know that as somebody that sits on the Mental Health Authority, I mean, I sometimes question whether we have too many silos. Okay, well, you know, we now that you've come to the emergency room, you know, we recognize that you have diabetes, and we recognize also that you're struggling with substance abuse or depression or whatever. Now you go across town and meet another stranger and wait in their lobby for a while, and then maybe you'll get treatment. And then you need to come back every 2 or 3 days. And you know how that will happen. It won't happen. So we'll continue to treat them in emergency room. And the cost will continue to escalate for all of us. And frankly, the care won't be there.
The care won't be there. We've seen violence in emergency rooms escalate significantly in the past 5 years because there's a gap in service for people who are in crisis. We do have more of the mobile crisis outreach suites here. And, along the bus at front, where instead of rolling an ambulance, you know, we're in a fire truck, police officer, we're rolling mental health professionals. But there's still a lot of the state that doesn't have access to those tools, and so this is the next frontier for sure for rooms to do. Oh, sorry, I didn't interrupt.
Everybody, you know, we all get colds and sinusitis, skin rashes. With physical health, we all have physical health issues all the time, you know, frequently. The same is true of mental health, except no one wants to identify it as a mental health issue until it's a crisis. But there, we all get anxiety or depression. That's a normal part of mental health, like physical health with colds and different medical ailments. And I think they need to be understood that, look, we all have it, we all have issues, and it's and a lot of it is primary care. And it needs to be addressed before it's a crisis, the mental health substance use issues.
I think part of the work of this group in terms of getting the right data and linking systems and coordinating, it's important to note that right now it's even hard for us to get a handle on what the need is because we've got different systems collecting different types of data. And this comes back to the challenge from a research perspective to figure out what policies need to be in place, what types of financial resources we need, where do they need to go until our data systems are more robust, and the DOH behavioral health system and Medicaid and DSAMH. It's a big issue, but until we get the data, it's hard for us to identify the need, and we're kind of piecing it together. Something else to tackle.
And I don't want to get off it too far, but it's part of the social determinants of health project. I sit on the board here at Duncan Miner, and you guys were there. We had a discussion about different systems and what can be done there. And I know this is only tangentially related because we have systems for different things, but the referral system that they're looking at right now, there's a possibility. One of the big issues we have in here, we've struggled with how to refer because we have regulatory environments that don't allow us to share information across systems. And so you've got health data that's protected and other data that's protected on the federal side. And there are different groups. The one they're looking at is doing this right now in North Carolina, but they do have a software system that takes care of all of that at any entry point. The person, you know, clicks the button and the waivers are all put into place. They've already done all of that work ahead of time. And then you can share that universally amongst different agencies, state, federal, local, all kinds of things. So there are solutions out there, but the problem is that unless we do it collectively, it doesn't help. And so we need to have a better discussion about the role the state plays in saying, okay, this is what we're going to do, and we need everybody to play along. That's hard for people.
Okay. So child welfare, do we have time to do one more?
Really?
Yeah.
Just want to be respectful of the agenda. Thanks.
Absolutely. So the mission of the Division of Child Family Services is to keep children safe from abuse and neglect, and to provide domestic violence services by working with communities and strengthening families. Research shows that quality outcomes are most often realized when children and families are actively engaged with an organization offering an array of effective services by qualified and committed staff. It is the aim of our practice model to create such an environment, staffed by the best child welfare professionals in the nation. Our findings: individuals experiencing intergenerational poverty were overrepresented in the child welfare system, both as victims of abuse and neglect in childhood and as perpetrators in adulthood. They were also more likely to have been foster children and as adults to be foster providers. The demographics of IGP children and adults in child welfare are similar to those traditionally identified as at risk for poverty in general. Children more likely to be from Native Americans, Black, Hispanic, or Pacific Islander populations, somewhat less likely to be white, and much less likely to be Asian than the state's general population. And adults were more likely to be female. That's, of course, in part because of the IGP cohort. IGP children were more likely to be referred as alleged victims of neglect. They were less likely to be referred as alleged victims of abuse than were Utah children in general. They were less likely to have been referred by public servants and authorities who are mandatory reporters of suspected abuse and neglect. A common assumption is that referrals to child protective and foster care services are increased due to families' involvement with other programs and services, such as law enforcement, public assistance, education, and health care. These observations fail to support that theory. Comparisons between cohorts suggest that the problems of intergenerational poverty and of poverty in general are strongly linked. That makes sense. It appears interventions and programs intended to address poverty in general may also be effective to address intergenerational poverty. We found that a lot in three studies. Just that it was hard for us to distinguish between characteristics of those that were intergenerational and those that were in poverty in general. Further study incorporating the narratives of poor and intergenerationally poor individuals and families will help us to better understand their experiences as they navigate the cost of poverty, to understand their movement through governmental benefit systems and programs, and to devise better solutions to overcome the obstacles to opportunity. So, do you have questions about child welfare? Because Ann can answer them.
That's great. I mean, really, thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you
very much. Okay.
Thank you, I don't have a handout or a slideshow in part because I'm concerned about handing out a report to you that is very limited based on data. So, you know, sometimes you put things out there and they get repeated and published, and I'm bringing this report to you to tell you that there are great data limitations around kindergarten and students living in conditions of intergenerational poverty affected by those conditions. So as we started looking at all of the data sets, I want to underscore what Tracy said about, and Lieutenant Governor, about the limitations of data sharing in our state. And so we were using two variables in looking at, or two data sets rather, and looking at did kindergarten extended make a difference for our cohort of 2012 students. So we looked at end of third grade level, English language arts scores, we'll talk about that and the limitations therein. And we also looked at DIBELS, which is our metric of looking at first and second grade, basically, readiness data in English language arts. Now we have two other data points in the future we'll be able to use that we're starting right now. And so we have key data that this group is weighted on, and that's a kindergarten readiness instrument that we use at the beginning and the end of kindergarten. And we also are just starting to use a very clever term called PEEP, which is the preschool instrument, to see about readiness. So those are two instruments that we'll be able to use to get better data in the future. So we looked at we took a swath of data, and we decided we needed to answer two research questions. The first was, among students identified in the 2013 IGP cohort, did students living in conditions of intergenerational poverty, and notice that I'm very specific in how I use that term. Before I die, I want us to stop labeling kids and families as IGP kids or IGP families or low-income students or low-income families. That's something I'm trying to crack in my own agency that we're having a hard time overcoming. Like, we all know that frame. We hold that frame and one of equity, but we use those terms as shortened terms. And so sometimes when we do that, we really label the person and we're really talking about the conditions. You know, are we trying to change the conditions for these students? So I don't mean to sound preachy. I'm preaching to myself because I lead an agency that's guilty of using this terminology. In looking at those conditions, so if they participated in a full-day kindergarten or an extended-day kindergarten, was there a difference between that and a traditional half-day kindergarten? And then the second research question that we looked at, when compared with similar peers, what percentage of students in this cohort, and again, this was a 2013 cohort, so they would have started kindergarten in the 2012 year, so we call it a 2013 year, what percentage met the annual DIBELS end of year benchmarks for reading levels as we projected that out through 2016? Okay, so those are kind of the two sets. End of level, third grade, and then how did we keep pace on DIBELS through 2016? So again, a lot of limitations to the data. And as we were looking at those two questions, a couple of things popped out that I thought this commission might be interested in. One is that, there was some promising practice around out-of-school or after-school programs. And so DWS and other members of this commission were at the table to help procure some funding through the legislature that then we were able to match and put some good funding into out-of-school or after-school programs targeted at cohorts of students who live in conditions of intergenerational poverty. And we saw that as we compared students who had engaged in after-school programs, we saw that they actually had higher increments of improvement on SAGE scores. So that variable alone I thought was very fascinating. We don't always talk about out-of-school or after-school programs and their connection to academic achievement, but we know that in Utah we have a lot of great after-school and out-of-school programs that are really connected to our standards and what's happening in schools, especially with a focus on STEM in a lot of these programs. So we're starting to see an impact there if you just pull out that specific variable. So we also found, when we were looking at trying to answer these research questions, we did not find really that much difference in looking at full day or extended day kindergarten, and I want to unpack why. Again, data is super limited on this. So we had in 2013 about 53,000 kindergarten students, and about 6% of those students were identified as students living in conditions of intergenerational poverty. So we're talking about a really small subset. What we couldn't flesh out in the variables was looking at things like their rates of absenteeism. We know when we look at chronic absenteeism, the kindergarten is one of the places where we have the highest levels of absenteeism, especially students who live in conditions of poverty, let alone conditions of intergenerational poverty. So kindergarten in this state is not required and oftentimes thought of as something that's not that important, and it doesn't matter if parents are educated don't have anything beyond a high school degree. It seems to be something that's just not in our mindset that kindergarten really is essential. So we have extremely high rates, or I should say a high differentiated rate of absenteeism in kindergarten compared to other grade levels. So that could be one variable that we didn't study. The other thing that is pretty impossible to unpack given the limited data set is the quality of instruction. So back in 2012-2013, when funding was starting to be put in to extended day or all-day kindergarten, we were not monitoring instruction of kindergarten at that time like we are now. So what we are finding is varying amounts of quality of instruction. So kids that were in this extended period, we found that teachers were sometimes just repeating what they had done in the morning instead of true interventions for these kiddos. So you have to just take all of those variables and say, how do you really unpack this black box of education and study each of those variables as independent variables? There's some data out there. I just have to throw this out there because when we were supporting legislation from Representative Lowry Snow on extended day kindergarten, we had data come to the table or research saying, well, it flattens out by third grade. And that's true if you only look at one variable, but you have to look at the interventions all along the way. The conditions are not changing at home. So what are we doing in terms of wraparound services and support? Are the students getting the kind of interventions they need, not only throughout school, but all the things that you've talked about today, the mental health, physical health, all of those kinds of intervention that make a difference. So Linda Darling-Hammond and others from Stanford just presented some data at the National Conference of State Legislators that I attended this last week, and they were talking about how that myth has been debunked, and there's a lot of research to show that it actually doesn't flatten out when you do a real good longitudinal study with appropriate interventions for students. So basically, trying to answer those two questions, we didn't find a huge variance on that cohort, but if Ben keeps asking these great research questions, if we were able to really have the appropriate longitudinal data and look at factoring out variables, I think given our monitoring focus now on instruction, having standards in place for quality preschool, having standards in place for kindergarten, and it's a more comprehensive social, emotional, and academic look at kindergarten, that we'll start to see different variables. And then I would tag that to what we were talking about earlier. When you see rural and remote areas who are partnering with Department of Health and Human Services to say, I know that you've got this counselor working with families at DHS, and can I use half of an FTE to pay for that person also to work at the junior high? This is happening in Wayne District and in Sevier and in San Juan, and they're starting to put health clinics in some of these remote or rural places where we're hearing that it's making a difference in school attendance and school outcomes. So placing a health center in Montezuma Creek area, the principals report kids are attending school, and they're attending at higher rates, and there's less mobility. So I just am so proud of the efforts this state is making to think of all of those things holistically that I'm confident will make an impact if we were to continue this study and look at a 2016 cohort or a 2017 cohort. So this data, I don't even really want to share because it's not super helpful, but I really am hopeful and confident of what we're doing now is making a dent in this field.
Questions? I'm sorry to keep
jumping.
Just a quick comment, it is super helpful. I mean, I don't think this should be a forum to talk about our best successes. I think you talk about what you're surprised by, what works, what doesn't. We'll have, I think, some interesting findings are not out of off the charts, but I think that helps us learn more. So I'm actually really excited to hear your results. And I've done some assessment of half and full day kindergarten nationally with old data, but there's new data out there. So if you want something from me in terms of getting a team together to get you a national picture and get the lit review together for you, I'm happy to do that.
That would be great, Ben, thank you. We have done some of that work, so we're using other data and other variables. We're already seeing that extended and full day are making a difference. This was targeted at students living in conditions of energetic generational poverty. So remember that 6% of that overall 52,000 cohort of kids. So when you expand that into students living in poverty that don't have the IGP tag on them, we find that in that space, we actually do much better. And then if you find students that may not be living at or below poverty, sort of in this middle space, lower middle income, those students tend to also do better with extended day kindergarten. So we've been reporting this to the legislature every year. We have to provide a formal report on the funds that we get. And our data on extended day K is great, and it's actually much better than preschool. Not that preschool isn't working, but we don't have the ability to monitor, regulate preschool. I think the commission that Tracy, you sit on, a commission or a designee, I believe, that's forthcoming.
I think I chair it.
You chair it. So
and you.
I think the commission.
Same group. Brown helping.
Yeah, it'll give us a better way, I think, to monitor. I have so many legislators stop me and say, what is better? You know, is it because there was an early learning strand at this conference, what is better, preschool or extended day kindergarten? My answer is always both. We need both. You know, you can't say one is better than the other, but we know that because we can control, monitor, look at the plans, that we have better research control over looking at extended day and full day kindergarten than we do right now with preschool.
Representative Thurston, welcome. You have a question?
Yeah. I'm going to ask a question that I know has no answer, but I just want to put it as a place marker. One of the discussions further on when we talked about preschool and all the kindergarten was, in addition to the benefit that it provides to the child in a learning environment, it provides a benefit to the parents from not having the child at home, if you will, because the parents can then work, they can do other things. It's not as disruptive to the day to have to drop off the kid at kindergarten and pick them up 3 hours later. Has anybody ever studied that to the point of, like, how much is this sort of filtering through this holistic impact of child care in a caring environment that allows parents to do other things?
Ben could probably answer that. We have not done that study.
But does it exist? Is there research out there?
Yeah, I mean, there's huge costs associated with daycare without kind of these formal institutions. So, I could get you in touch with some good literature that could give you some insight. But I think it's fairly intuitive. You're right. That there are benefits to labor market participation, deferred costs for child care, which are excessive. I think in dual income households, sometimes the cost almost equalizes the pay that a caregiver has to pay, that gets from their job. It's a displacement. I think your thoughts on that are very intuitive, and there's literature to support.
And Lieutenant Governor, if I could just end with a postscript. My hope is that as a state, we really embrace the importance of urban learning. And the parents are the first and primary teachers of our kiddos, and we should acknowledge that, embrace that, and work with parents in a very formal and triangulated way in this work. But early, there are some specific strategies within early learning that we hope to promote and continue to promote, because it's critical to our students doing better and being better and getting out of the cycle of intergenerational poverty.
No, I agree. And thank you. Figuring out what this data is really telling us is interesting, and we're going to have to spend some more time with it. But it could also be telling us that it's even harder with kids who are living in intergenerational poverty, and they need more than just a couple more hours in kindergarten. There's lessons to be learned either way.
So. I love Ben's comment too about, at least in more questions, that's a great research project, is what questions are still unanswered that we can pursue. So thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you. All right, that finishes our agency studies findings. And thanks to everyone, our agency heads, the researchers that presented today, and those that have worked hard on this. We want to continue to learn as we move forward so that we can improve and help more people on the road to getting out of the condition of energy poverty. So with that, let's go ahead. We have our subcommittee update and recommendation. Commissioner Ivers, welcome.
Thank you, Commissioner Governor.
You can trip up here.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, Brian. First of all, just as I start off, I just really want to thank both Tracy and TJ. They've been great help to the county. Since our last meeting, I think you've met with all of the counties, right?
Not all, but a good portion of them.
All of the counties addressing the conditions of intergenerational poverty. I'm going to keep trying on that one. So, very quickly, just giving a report on our July 31st subcommittee meeting that was held. We had about half the members, half the counties represented there. And I apologize, there was some scheduling conflicts, so we would have had much more. But in discussing that with the counties, the good news is there is movement in all of the counties as far as addressing their plans, more than others, some more than others. And even those counties that didn't necessarily receive a grant are still moving forward trying to implement their plan to address the conditions of intergenerational poverty. So as far as kind of some of the reports, we're kind of at a crossroads with the counties, I believe, as far as, as you have elections, as you have new commissioners coming in, trying to get them up to speed, trying to get, the right partners in place. We felt that we're going to go to meeting twice a year, and that we will be able to bring requests and suggestions back to this committee and back to the state legislature as well.
It's going to be a lot easier to have these messy elections.
Yeah. Well, I think if an initiative passes, we'll probably have more, more turnover than we have.
See that jokingly to the media in the room. We have. It's a reminder to everyone to vote today in your municipal elections.
Since most of us have gone to vote by mail, we've been voting over the last 2 weeks, right?
I believe that's right.
I think there's two issues that we'd like to continue to bring up. One is child care. That continues to be a problem as we help our families. And then the second is affordable housing. Neither one of those issues are a surprise to anybody. We've talked about it several times in this meeting, and there's something that all of you are very aware of. And just like social determinants of health, I'm not sure we have the solutions, but those are things that we're going to continue to be working on. We'd like to, as far as asks for this committee, we'd like to ask that the State Housing Commission have an IGP as a targeted group for vouchers. And just kind of really recognize that. And then the second is on the grants. We need to extend that to at least 2 years as far as, 1 year is all you know. By the time you get everything set up and ready to go, it's time to report on the grant and you haven't had a chance to implement it. And as far as something else, I'd like to suggest that any simplicity that we can bring to the process. Now, John just told me to suck it up and remember this government
that
was not a part of
it. Instead of a friend. Yeah. Honestly, you're not a record.
Is this a public meeting? I say a lot of things. I'm a reporter. But anyway, any simplicity we can bring to it would be very good. I want to tell you in Washington County, I'm proud of our committee continues to meet frequently, both our subcommittee and our overall committee. I think that's one of the good things that the idea of getting this down to the county level is doing. It's allowing the partners and the people that are working in this field to be together and to talk. And there's been a lot of wins, small wins and big wins. Everything from, for example, getting grants for certain schools to bring in STEM programs because we have both our extension officer there and we have somebody from the school district, so on and so forth. There's been a lot of things that we can kind of brag about or things that are good. This is a very complicated issue as we've already talked about. So
that's great.
That's kind of our report unless there's any questions.
Thank you. No, and I would just add to that, we had a conversation with Tracy the other day and it was about that. encouraged we are that so many counties really are moving forward, pushing forward, and the support has been phenomenal. So please know that on not just behalf of Washington County, but all the counties, and share that with your colleagues for their great work there.
Very good. And I do think it's important we continue to not give up on counties, even when there's a change or it seems like it's starting to, not have as much energy as it should. Because hopefully all of us know that this is a generational problem as well as an intergenerational problem, and the solution might be intergenerational as well.
Great. So thank you for the recommendations. We have a couple of those. I think the first one was on the affordable housing piece, getting on that task force set up by the legislature, and I think we can make that recommendation. Any thoughts on that? So I think most of you know that the legislature, working with the executive branch, we're working on solutions around affordable housing and those recommendations. I think the recommendation from you, your group, is that we need to have actual representation on that. Is that correct?
Yeah.
From the counties on that. So while we don't have authority over that, we as a group can go and ask the legislature and request that we put someone on there, and I think they would be open to that. So what we need from this body is just if you're encouraged and willing to do that, that we just collectively make that position of the group and of the commission and go and make that ask on their behalf. So I would leave that for a motion or discussion.
And I'll make that motion.
Thank you.
Second.
Okay. Second, any further discussion?
Who are the voting members of that?
I don't have those in front of me.
Do you mean
to vote right now?
Yeah.
So it would just be members, just commission members. Thank you.
Yeah. Perfect.
Just commission members. Okay. All right, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. We will carry that forward. The second request is, and I don't think we need a motion for this one, but the request is to add an additional year with the grants so that we can continue to gather data from that. I think there's wisdom in that. My only caution would be that we only request those counties that are collecting data and are in the process of doing that, where we can go back to the legislature and say, look, we're getting, this is what's happening, we're getting that data, we need a little more time to make sure that we get everything we need. Is that?
Yeah, I think the legislature, that you advised it back to me, they probably ought to receive some sort of reporting where we indicate, hey, look, we have these programs set up and ready to go, this is what's happened, but we need a little more time, because my understanding is the reason they gave the money was to promote innovation, to promote, and if they pull it back too quickly, they're not going to get what they
so we probably do need a motion on this. That's a very good point. So the request would be to go back and deliver a report to the legislature asking them for additional time for these projects that are showing. If we have a project that's clearly not working, we don't want to extend that. These that where we are getting good results in one more time. Fair? Is that okay?
In my particular county, we haven't really had time to spend the grant yet.
Yeah.
We're set up and ready to go, and we've been mentioned it to several participants. We need a little more time in order to collect data.
Okay, how does the please?
So Mr. Darrow?
I think Drew needs to continue to write it on the line here.
I'll be happy to make that motion and speak to it after a second.
Yeah, we have a motion.
Second.
Second, please.
Our experience in similar grants, whether it's been digital teaching learning or anything that's a two-year grant, that first year has been truly, as Commissioner Iverson explained, it's really been a planning grant, and year two it's been spending the grant. When we've been given one-year grants for a cohort, we just never see the results. So I fully support that recommendation. And then since they already have a grant awarded, you can consider that the planning grant year, basically, or an extension of the grant.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none. none. Again, board members, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, we'll get that back. And we'll also work on
some. If lobbying the state legislature was this easy.
All right, thank you.
Is there anything need to be done? The vouchers?
I think what we really want is that voice on the board.
That's the piece, yeah, on the committee working on the voucher piece. So. All right, next up, we and this may not be on some of your agendas, I apologize. We have some that have and some that don't, but Commissioner Ivey is here with us. Commissioner, welcome. We're great to have you here from Utah County. Is going to share with us the program research findings from the circles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee, for giving us the opportunity to come and present to you today. What we really wanted to do is give you guys a glimpse at how the good work you're doing here and with the support from the state legislature is actually impacting people's lives, and how we're specifically measuring where this money's going and the programs that are being instituted, and if they're truly affecting people's lives. In Utah County, when we developed our plan, one of our main focuses was taking an individualistic approach rather than a program approach. We wanted to touch individual lives. And so we looked at places where that could happen so that these individuals could build quality social capital and as a result have a better outlook on their lives to escape poverty. One of the programs that was being offered in Utah County at a couple of various locations was the Circle program. Circles connects participants who are 150% or below the federal poverty line with a mentor. This mentor then goes ahead and helps teach these individuals basic life skills. We wanted to see if these particular types of programs or this approach was truly affecting people's overall outlook on life and helping them escape poverty within the 18-month parameters set by the program. To do this, we took a RCT approach to our study. So we wanted a randomized program, so we kicked it out to Facebook and other areas to encourage people to sign up, and then we took about half those qualified individuals and actually put them in the program, and half of them we didn't, because we needed that control group to see if being in this program actually really worked and created the results that we were looking for as far as improving these people's outlooks on life. And when we get it up, we have a little bit of a slide that will show you some of the graphics here. What we were looking at, we wanted to study a couple particular areas. Particularly, we wanted to look at perceived constraints, the positive relationships these individuals have with others, their environmental mastery, their self-acceptance, their sense of control, their social connections, their purpose in life, their general self-efficiency, autonomy, personal mastery, and personal growth. And as you're going through this mentoring process, we developed a series of questions in each of these categories that we felt would strongly identify whether the participation in this Circles program was helping these people build better social capital and build a more positive outlook on life. On the back of the handout we have here, you'll see we had some very encouraging results. Generally speaking, there is a casual connection between participation and outlook on life comparing the standardized scores of participants with non-participants. So what we're saying is that we had standard deviations, but when you participated in this program, overall, there was a positive net effect in the vast majority of the categories. Interestingly enough, personal mastery and personal growth were very affected by the place that you were attending the program. And so we're going to continue to study and do some follow-up with these individuals in these groups to see exactly why that's happening. We have some theories that probably the reason this is occurring is you might have like a mentor or a program director who delivers a lot of fluff versus a director who is real. He tells these people it's going to be hard, you're going to have to get a job, you're going to have to, you know, put the metal to the wheel and work to get yourself out of poverty. So we're curious as to that effect. And that's part of the real reason we wanted two particular areas to study. In Utah County, we studied the Provo and the American Fork programs. But overall, we're seeing very, very positive outcomes. And what these people are getting through this type of mentorship is the social capital and the self-awareness to make those positive choices and then have the support system around them through their increased social capital to follow through with their job, getting to work, and the other aspects that kick them back into the poverty cycle. So So they're building that network of friends that we generally take for granted to actually escape the cycle. And so we feel that the research is very encouraging. We're very happy with the model that we've developed in developing this data. We feel like it's giving us some very accurate results. And obviously there's still a little bit of work to do so we understand some of these finer points and why we have some discrepancy in some of the areas. But overall, we're very encouraged that after just this 6-month review and hopefully the 12-month review, we're seeing these people really make strides in escaping poverty. And so obviously by the end of the 18-month period where they're supposed to be out of poverty, that they'll actually have accomplished that and be on solid ground there. So in conclusion, we can certainly say that the CIRCLES program itself is making a difference. It's worth continued investment. And more so, we feel that we can say that investing in these one-on-one individual mentorship type of programs, where we take that individualistic approach, truly empowers people out of poverty rather than a larger bureaucratic program. So that's some of the stuff. Dr. Ben Gibbs from BYU headed the study for us, and we had some wonderful students who worked on it who are here today. If you guys have some questions, they'd be able to get into the weeds a little better than I can. But that's the general overall work we're doing from Utah County and some of the findings we're having in this program, and we're very encouraged by it.
Ben, go ahead.
So the intervention groups were both pro and American Fork. What was your control? Did you have control of them?
Yes. So this was heartbreaking. So to do a randomized control trial, you have to over-recruit people. Yeah. And CIRCLES is like word of mouth, like, you know, hey, come in this program, we're going to help you. And so we over-recruited through Facebook ads and other methods, and then we randomly selected people into it and randomly selected people not to be into it. So that's a high bar for causality, but what it means is some of these programs look really effective because they select on very motivated people. Yeah. But we got all the motivated people, and then we divided them in half. And so that helps us feel more confident that CIRCLES is really changing their outlook, because we're comparing it with equally motivated people.
I have questions.
I have a question. I mean, we're running some CIRCLES programs in Washington County, and we really believe in this ally peer support. We've run into a couple problems making council assign. One is simply getting people. That's one of the challenges. And then keeping them there, you know, sometimes in their busy lives, you mentioned gift cards or, you know, incentives.
That was for the study. Right. They just have dinners. They don't offer cash incentives.
So you felt like just social media and other ways you were able to get enough participants?
We talked about Facebook ads. I think that cost us some money at the BYU side. I forgot what the bill was. It was like $5,000 or something. And that was our sole method of getting more people. They had relied just on word of mouth, and they just barely got enough participants. But Provo's healthier than the other cities, and if you have a tradition of it, word gets around that it's helpful. So sometimes it takes time, and it takes a dynamic coordinator. As you can see, the differences between these two groups can vary based on who's running the show.
Absolutely.
Let's chat more.
Yeah. I'd be interested in more data and best practices, whatever you can do that. And we have had success. I'm not going to say we haven't, but that I believe in it, and it's just a matter of, you know, how to run best practice.
I believe in it in principle, I believe in it, but it depends who you fill it with. Right. And it depends what goals they make. It depends how dynamic the coordinator is. It depends how many volunteers you have and what goals they set. So I think that's the promise of it. Is we know social capital matters, but we don't know how to build it. And I think, Lieutenant Governor, your argument that government knows how to bring people together is a great argument for we know how to build social capital. Delivering it, paying for it, different things, right? But so CIRCLES may not work for other reasons, but I think, in my point of view, the principles of it capture kind of why an LDS ward does well. It brings random people together and serves them. It's why a government entity might work. So that's why I think we should be having rigorous evaluation of these things. So if it's not working, it should be working. And that's what I love about Jen Nibley's approach to this. It's like, tell me if it's not working, because I want to make changes to it. And that's why I like your approach is, hey, let me report on some modest results. Because it makes me think, I thought it would work. I thought full-day kindergarten would work. So in some ways, this is more than just about circles. It's like, let's evaluate this stuff and be honest with what we're finding. So if the things we think are working aren't working, then let's make some adjustments.
I think that was one of the things from our perspective, particularly the county, and why we instituted this particular kind of study, is we wanted it to be a little harsh to some degree, right? And with the over-recruitment, we made that study harsh. But give us a realistic approach. Is this something that we've dreamed up in our minds that we think is a great idea? Or is this truly beneficial to people's lives? And by taking this particular type of approach with the study, we're finding it's truly beneficial to people's lives. And so then we can use the various entities, as Dr. Gibbs said, to try and rally people around these institutions or places where they can build that capital on a one-on-one basis.
Just one comment I'll have. We picked an outcome that was not established by circles, and that was outlook, efficacy. And we felt like, what could we capture 6 months into the project that's not poverty, or getting out of poverty, because it's too soon for the program to expect those results. We thought the individual change in how you see yourself and how you see your future is something that we don't measure enough, and circles needs to measure. How do you change someone's optimism? And so these results are modest, but they're robust, and I think it's changing the way people see themselves and they see the future. So I don't know if it'll actually change their salary, but my goodness, I think this is the first step. It's a psychological conversion to I can get something done. And so that makes me excited across a lot of different metrics of outlook, almost all of them, we see some benefit to Circle's participation. I'd be surprised if there weren't some benefits to thinking positively about control, efficacy in your life. But time will tell. We'll be back in 6 months.
Well, it certainly fits with all the other data that we've seen on, and it was interesting you brought up a faith-based organization as a comparison of the studies that have come out of Harvard on the loss of those types of social institutions that have historically brought people together, whether it was churches or volunteer organizations, the Elks Lodge or the whatever it is, those organizations that brought people together, gave them social capital. When they did have hit a rough patch, they were surrounded by people who kind of lift them up and help them out. And we've lost that, especially with this cohort. And yes, the power of positivity, we would expect great things from us. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for your willingness as a county to do this. This is what we're hopeful for. We spend a lot of money helping people get out of poverty that doesn't help people get out of poverty. If we can spend that in a better way, that where there are actual results, we should be doing it. And we're not very good at this government. We're not very good at saying, this program should work, or it used to work, or it might work. We don't know. We're going to keep doing it. We've always done.
How much should this study cost your county?
Nothing.
Zero. Yeah, we really like that.
If we had the real fight was between the green and blue, which university?
We're lucky to have many wonderful, robust institutions of higher learning.
And I think that I would make a pitch that Dr. Gibbs and his team did a phenomenal job. But we have found great success in the county with poverty and with some of our other social issues, as we've teamed with our universities for this type of research. And so when we work together collaboratively with the research teams, we're doing some domestic violence stuff in the county, and we're teaming with some UD people, and it's really made a difference because we're doing it on facts. And these things are actually impactful, and the universities have been a great partner in helping us have that happen.
Congratulations. Thank you. On behalf of all of us, this is information that we can share with other counties and help move that along. Okay. All right, moving on to the, I believe it's the last item on our agenda. Mary Beth, thank you so much. Welcome back. As many of you know, Resilient Utah was established by the commission, by us, a couple of years ago to talk about making and research making Utah a trauma-informed state.
Yes,
we know, again, there's research around trauma-informed decision-making is growing. We know how important it is. We know we haven't done a very good job with it in the past, and we want to do a better job in the future. So Mary Beth is here to talk us through the findings.
Thank you for the opportunity to share the fruit of actually 2 years of work with Resilient Utah and our committee. Some of the committee members are here, so I thank you for your presence. It is a real privilege to be able to talk about some of the experiences of some of the folks that have come around the table and shared about what Resilient Utah could be. But I can say for myself, after 20 years of serving as a researcher for the Department of Workforce Services, can I own my anxiety right now?
It's
We're talking
fine.
About owning mental health issues. I'm owning my anxiety.
vulnerability.
That's right. After 20 years and going into a lot of people's homes, we've seen a lot of trauma, a lot of stories of real challenge, but also probably more than anything, I've been impressed by amazing amounts of resilience and how people are able to bounce back and do well over time. So this product is a fruit of that experience. Just to keep us all on the same page as we get started, we want to think about those two sides of the coin, trauma and resilience. Trauma happens when a person is overwhelmed by something beyond their control, when our physical and psychological safety is threatened. I've noticed in some conversations there's a bit of trauma fatigue, I think. Sometimes people getting the idea that trauma has become the new excuse for not wanting to do things, right? It's something we can blame. On the other hand, there seems to also be a greater social understanding when we think about veterans and being sensitive around fireworks seasons, or thinking about law enforcement and schools working together when a child has experienced domestic violence the night before, letting a teacher know this child might be upset or have some difficulties. Resilience, I think exactly what Ben was talking about. I was going to label your work with some of these folks as resilience. We know that there's hope because we can build resilience in people and it comes through relationship. So there are good things we can do to overcome some of the issues. Trauma holds people in survival mode. Resilience gives them hope to break free. However, different experiences happen when trauma occurs in childhood. And the Adverse Childhood Experiences study is something that has gotten a lot of attention because it found a strong correlation between those adverse childhood experiences, things that happened to us as kids, and poor physical, mental health issues, chronic health, low life potential, early death, all of the things that were talked about in some of the data earlier related to intergenerational poverty. There's also employment problems, relationship problems, all aspects of adult living. Neuroscience is discovering that a significant impact of these events can have on a child's brain and development of executive functioning. Interestingly, there was an article out last week that was funded by the Institute, the National Institute of Justice, that they looked at every mass shooting of four or more shooters from 1966 until now. They had four things in common. And one of those things was early childhood trauma and exposure to violence as a youth.
So I talked about this morning. You know, there's a lot of talk around this issue, of course, with mass shootings and what the answer is. And everybody's trying to find the common thread. And this is the one. ACEs, I mean, they've all had very traumatic childhoods.
Yeah. It's a huge correlating factor, so it's important. And we know that there's an economic burden with trauma as well. Beyond the physical and emotional things for the individual, there's also impacts on our community between all of the social costs that people experience, as well as our loss of productivity, the labor that we lose from individuals who aren't part of the market. One of our intergenerational poverty moms several years ago talked about that intergenerational poverty, there's a lot of great minds lost to poverty. And I would suggest there's a lot of great minds lost to trauma. The economic costs analysis, when we look at child maltreatment, the economic costs of child maltreatment are well known. Millions and millions of dollars lost to that. Some of the Department of Health data earlier spoke to that. There's also a link between higher ACEs and higher rates of prescription drug testing. So recognizing childhood experiences impact on adult mental health. We can also see that when it comes to Utah, we're not immune from these issues. The blue bars are from the behavior risk factors surveillance system data from the Department of Health that shows that overall in Utah, more than 62% have at least one childhood adverse experience or more. The yellow bars are data that we're collecting right now from our families on cash assistance. are poor families. When we see that almost 60% four more of the adverse childhood experiences, the link between intergenerational poverty or poverty in general and these childhood experiences is huge. Even the red bars, that shows our workers, our frontline staff, their levels of trauma are higher as well. This is a huge issue. I could go on with all kinds of examples of different situations, but we recognize that Utah is not immune from these issues, and we're here to figure out where do we go with it. While we are taking steps, the good news is that we're not the first people to do this. There's a lot of other states that have created trauma-informed efforts to be able to try to address some of these issues. Many of them have examples of programs that address childhood trauma, building resilience, preventative measures, community partnerships. There's also a lot of examples of funding through public-private partnerships, accessing federal grants, cross-sector collaborations, and systems change. These are very large efforts. After looking at a lot of the different examples, Trauma-Informed Oregon really stood out as one that we wanted to pay some attention to because it held a lot of the principles and values that we have here in Utah. One of the pieces they show that I think is really interesting is this roadmap to trauma-informed care. It's a roadmap that reminds us that this is a process. This isn't a one-and-done training or an opportunity where people can just come and learn about it and then move back into their regular life. It's a process that takes time. It's really a paradigm shift or a different lens through which we see experiences and people in our community. There's a lot of evidence coming out of the federal level as well, the importance of several ingredients, taking an integrative approach. We talked about silos earlier of different agencies. The integration of different efforts are really key to success. Common language, what does trauma-informed even mean? Those are important pieces. Harnessing the strength and knowledge within families and communities. Circles does a good example of that. Recognizing that families have to be around the table. We can't just do to or without them. There's been evaluations of programs across the country that look that need to focus on systems change, measuring change in families and changes within children and families, not just within our structures. So really the trauma-informed approach is the key. It's one in which all of the components of a social service system, not just looking at frontline workers, but at policy, at leadership, at our spaces, all of those pieces have to be part of the change to be able to make a difference. And the cost savings that have been found through trauma approaches are really exciting. Self-healing communities model out of Horowitz, Washington, found a 31-to-1 return on investment. So for every dollar invested, $35 were saved through this program that they did. We don't always see the direct links. So like in education, Walla Walla, Washington, that was part of Paper Tigers, many of you have seen that, 85% reduction in out-of-school suspension rates. When you can increase graduation rates, we know that we're going to increase participation in the labor force and reduce costs. So those are ways that we can see the cost benefits across systems. Changes in the criminal justice or prison systems, realizing that 91% of people will eventually get out of prison. What can we do to improve their outcomes when they come back to their cities and their families? So do we have any interest in doing something in Utah? I think that we have a strong evidence that we do. Resilient Utah, to answer that question, last winter and fall, conducted a survey statewide to find out from state agencies and organizations what's actually happening out there. What's the level of interest or appropriateness for trauma-informed approaches? The data presented here, and I have to give credit to Rick Little from Human Services and the team from the Department of Health that did a lot of the analysis of this data. They found that 82% agreed that a trauma-informed approach is appropriate for their agency. So for most places, they can see the link between a trauma-informed approach and what they're actually doing in their day-in and day-out activities. And many of them are also actively engaged in these activities, but they need more support in areas like policy, evaluation, training, and workforce development. Probably the most exciting outcome to me was looking at the question about whether your agency would be interested in following up something in the future. Saying yes on a survey and saying yes, I want help long term is really a different step. So 76% saying yes, possibly or definitely, there's interest in wanting to move something forward. So we take that and put it together and say, what do we know? We know there's a lot of ACEs in Utah. It's not just among our low-income population, but it's among people in general. Suicide rates, Levels of opioid misuse are high in Utah. We're missing out on a lot of the gifts and talents that people in our community have to offer. We care about each other. We want to be part of supporting something, but we need some place to be able to do that. And a lot of the agencies really are beginning to employ trauma-informed approaches and trying to make those efforts. So there's a desire to learn more and to grow. And many of us are doing training around people that are looking and seeking to do that growth in trauma-informed approaches. Every time the counties have an IGP grant and they incorporate trauma-informed approaches, we get more and more calls to go out and do some more training with those folks. Becky King from Human Services has done incredible amounts of work. Teresa and Sheila from Department of Health, Dorothy Hall from Workforce Services. A lot of different entities are beginning to help. Even some of my colleagues at SRI are working with HB 177 and they're the victim advocate groups to be able to do some trauma-informed work. But there's a lot of us that are working in silos. There's a lot of us that are doing things and are not connecting or being asked to serve as populations that we don't know much about. So those are some barriers. A lot of times agency people are doing things as a side job. It's not part of their main work description, but it's being something that they're asked to do in addition to all of their other duties. So there's not really this very specific focus on helping an agency become trauma-informed. It's part of a bigger picture, and there's just so much to be done. In a sense, for example, when we did the work with Workforce Services, we trained them about how to be more trauma-informed in working with their clients. The clients trust them more. They start telling more stories, and their workers are feeling overwhelmed. What do I do with all this trauma that I've been told? The levels of secondary trauma are going up, but we don't have anything in place for step two. What do you do next? We're very good at trauma 101, the basic approach, but we don't have a lot of efforts moving beyond that. And because you think about each agency creating its own system, there's enormous duplications of effort. A lot of time and energy wasted in each group trying to be able to recreate the will for themselves. And we don't have a lot of good measures for success. As Ben is asking so many good research questions, what does success mean in trauma-informed? How are we measuring it? How are we working with families to know that there is actually a difference being made? So given the good work that's been identified and the energy and desire to move forward, Resilient Utah determined that creating a center for Resilient Utah was what would be recommended as a way to move Utah forward to becoming a trauma-informed state. So a center for Resilient Utah, what would that look like? Ideas on the potential roles and responsibilities for a center, which would service all of the state of Utah across all sectors, could be providing foundational knowledge on trauma-informed approaches, supporting cross-sector collaborations. Good things are happening, like I said, but very much in silos. It could provide a capacity-building opportunities to support training development, online modules, workforce wellness and support, provide technical assistance for implementing evidence-based policies and processes. They could build and maintain a centralized list of trauma and resiliency-informed resources. This is hugely important in thinking about rural areas who want to be able to access resources and don't know who's even available in their area to be able to do that. Developing processes for conducting readiness assessments, developing mechanisms for evaluating financial costs versus benefits to the community, thinking about outcome measures that would be important for us to measure across all sectors, not just individually, but looking at where it functions the best, families and systems, incorporating processes for sustainability for the approach, because that's really the goal long term, is sustainability. When we think about these goals, really the ultimate goal of a Center for Resilient Utah would be to look at the work to support incorporation of a trauma-informed approach into the daily activities and culture of agencies and organizations across the entire state. Support the creation of sustainable processes and structures within organizations with the potential, eventually, to even be able to scale back the center. Once that becomes culture of the agencies, organizations are training new folks coming in as part of the way they do business every day, the scope of the center might actually be able to scale back. Ultimately, we care about the citizens of the state of Utah. We want to reduce the suffering of Utahns who have experienced trauma, build up and support resilient, self-reliant individuals and families, and improve outcomes for the next generations of Utahns. Many of you have the proposal that we put together. That's kind of a very brief, quick summary of what that would look like. And so we'd like to entertain any questions. And I believe that might be Doug on the phone when that click came in. Thoughts, questions? Yeah.
Who would be in that center? Who would, what kind of individuals would be participating in that?
Running the center? Or?
Yeah.
So different models across the country are connected with different entities. In looking at the different concerns or questions that come with each kind of option, some talk about it being housed in a government agency, others within like a university, a research institute. Some have nonprofits that are specifically developed to lead those groups. I think within Utah, that would be part of what would be the next step of the decision, would to say what's the best group that would have the most flexibility, the most opportunity to reach statewide to be able to service those needs. And to be able to fulfill the capacity of both research as well as training, looking at best practices for a statewide effort.
Is there a recommendation in that regard?
The recommendation, I think, would only be based on what we know from the trauma-informed Oregon, because that really seems to be the best model. They're based out of a research institution at Portland State University, but they also, in speaking with them, we spent a lot of time communicating with them. They also could see it being a nonprofit, a research-based nonprofit that could be created to do that.
Yes, can I add something?
Please, yeah, welcome. So,
thank you. So my name is Steve Price. I actually come from the private sector. I am not involved in any of the work that you're doing, which is tremendous and terrific. So I'll tell you this. About 3.5 years ago, Scott Anderson showed a film. It was a Jamie Redford film called Resilience. The follow-up film to that was Paper Tigers, and it was right at the time when some of the work that you were doing and many others at Project Rio Grande was happening. And for those of us that saw that film, we knew that day, what all of you know for a long, long time, that most of the challenges and problems that we face in society begin when people are really young. So these early childhood traumas, and based on those two studies, these ACE scores, which are pretty definable, lead to the pipelines that we have today. So intergenerational poverty or first-generation poverty, delinquency, prison population, substance abuse, mental illness, and it's not always a cause of mental illness, but if we look at all these pipelines and these things in society, we've been looking for a long time for a silver bullet, and this is probably the silver bullet. And so, as a result of this task force, the Center for Resilient Utah, this is an aspirational goal, but we don't have time to wait. We have 29 counties in the state of Utah. And we're large enough to get something like this done, but we're also small enough to get it done. And it's going to take both. And so it will take the healthcare providers, the public sector, the private sector, or, you know, the healthcare providers, you know, our religious institutions to come together. But this is scalable. This is doable. And this is so important that for all of us under our watch, each of you are kind of an architect of the future, sitting around this table. You're an AIA. As architects of the future, we have obligations and responsibilities and opportunities. And one of those opportunities is to build this center. And so as we've looked at this and as we've watched it, we already know the research has been done. Just sitting on this back row listening to each of you presenting each of the things that you're talking about, we know these early childhood traumas and what that leads to. And so this is a center to bring together the whole state. And so as this work has begun, it was investigative, it was exhaustive, it was careful, and the experts that came together were very, very mindful to bring together their collective experience to make sure that today when they presented was something that was tangible and something that was doable.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other thoughts?
What are the next steps?
I think, and thank you, Steve. I think the next steps that we imagine, because there was a challenge, and we were challenged actually to say that your proposal doesn't have a lot of specifics, and other people saying it's good your proposal doesn't have specifics. We don't feel like we're the experts at being able to say exactly what this should look like in Utah. There's a lot of basic concepts, and in the fact sheet that I passed around, there's a lot more detail about what's been done and a lot of evidence to be able to suggest options that could be explored. I think the next steps would be to call together primary leaders from each of your organizations, for each of them the state agencies, and then partners from the private sector, anyone interested to say what would this look like, and really hammer out exactly what the framework should look like, what the ask would be as far as financial funding. We have that data from Trauma Informed Oregon to be able to say what fits best for Utah to meet all of these goals about being statewide, inclusive, both child-centered and adult-centered, for building capacity, being a resilient state.
Thank you.
I have just one question. So what was the investment then from Oregon?
It's about $900,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And when you think about all the numbers that were being thrown around about the cost benefits to being able to, you're not going to realize it in a year. But when you've avoided a prison sentence, when you've avoided child maltreatment, you've made up those dollars very quickly.
Yeah, and to Steve, to your point, the data is very clear on this. I think I have to tell you, I've spoken on ACES 3 times in the last week.
Why didn't you give this?
it really is, again, about getting upstream of these issues. And I've seen it in my own family, I've seen it in others. We all know this. And unless, that's why when this guy came to my office, this was the conversation we had about trauma, resiliency amongst our young people, and this is where we solve a host of problems that are plaguing our country right now. Mm-hmm. So we can't move fast enough. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Just in support of the center, I also think it takes leadership to talk about ACEs a certain way and resiliency a certain way. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of various ways we think about it, and I enjoy talking with Mary Beth about it because I feel like she understands this issue pretty deeply. But I don't know that we uniformly understand what we mean when we say resilience and ACEs. And so I think a center can help kind of with leadership of kind of understanding really how we execute, how we talk about it. Does it mean, all poor people are abused? I mean, that's, I think, an often concluded thought when we think about it. So to me, there's also a leadership component with the center.
And I appreciate that, Ben. I think framing the issue is critical. The national literature talks about trauma as a public health crisis. And when you think about what we do with public health crises, we educate. We help the broad community, not just focus on low-income or vulnerable populations, but understand that this is part of something that belongs to all of us, and taking it out of the shadows.
And done right, Ben, to your point. I mean, there are a few examples of this as we look back through just even over the past few years. I'll give you one. STEM is a great example, right? 5 years ago, nobody knew what STEM was. Nobody had heard of STEM. And then to the point where 3 years ago, everybody that wanted a bill passed in the legislature tried to tie to STEM somehow.
Yeah.
Because STEM was the buzzword, and they knew leadership had finally bought in to STEM, whatever that
That's
meant.
How you can pay for the center.
That's right.
I mean, that is STEM.
IGP and STEM, and we're set.
No, but actually, IGP became one of those things, too, to where we were getting requests from every, like, I want to do something in IGP. Like, this is the thing. And that's because we did a good job of informing and bringing leaders on. And this has the potential for that in a very, very positive way, if we can bring people on board. You started out by saying, though, that the trauma is being overused, and you're correct. And the pushback starts to be, everybody has trauma. I turned out okay. What's wrong with the rest of you? Stop looking for excuses. And that's not what this is about. That's why we do need to educate and help people understand. No. We agree. Everybody does have a difficult circumstance. We want to help them overcome that so that they can prosper and not use that as an excuse not to. So.
It's not unlike mental health.
Right.
The stigma that goes with mental health is very similar to that of trauma. And a part of the research is talking about the thing that gets in the way of people seeking mental health services is their mental health. So the thing that gets in the way of recognizing and owning trauma is our trauma. And when we bring that out into the light and help people understand that that's part of what many of us experience and carry, we're less likely not to engage with it.
Yeah. Lieutenant Governor Ben, you know, this is a simple and it's an anecdotal story. I have a father who's a Holocaust survivor, and he made it out with one brother. And so I have no other relatives on that side of the family. They're all gone. And just after I saw this film, Resilience, I was in Palm Springs at a hospital, and I was just talking to someone randomly. And he said, you know, so your father's a Holocaust. He asked about the last name. And so my last name was reassigned to Ellis Island. And he said, is your father a thriver or a survivor? And I really had to think about that. And he came to this country, and he turned out to be a thriver. His brother's a survivor. There's a big difference. And a large part of what that was is the resilience. And so why do some become so much more resilient and some not? So we know the trauma, but then the resilience is the other part. You know, it's like the left-right part of the brain. It's like a left and right lung. So what is it that makes inside someone, or what can we do to facilitate the resilience?
I completely agree that it's critical. So let's do this. I'd love to get the interest of the commission. We have an opportunity. I'm happy to help convene through my office, bring the interested parties together, work on next steps if the commission wants to endorse that process and move forward, if that's helpful. I know I haven't asked, but I'm sure these guys
that'd
have
be great.
Staff and
that'd
we,
be,
that we can yeah. move yeah. on. Yeah, so,
she and I were talking before earlier today and said, this is kind of like the third leg of a stool. We had Intergenerational Poverty Commission, the Commission on Early Childhood, and now Resilient Utah. And, you know, I don't know when the funding will be available, but somehow we got to say we have it and look for funding to, because it ties so closely with the other early childhood and intergenerational poverty.
No, it does. You're absolutely right. And if we are looking at one of our institutions of higher education, there may be already funds available that can be supplemented by the legislature as we work through this process. That's not a very big number in the grand scheme of things. You know, that could be absorbed potentially right away with, you know, the University of Utah or some or an institution like that. So, we're willing to take this and work together on it. Further discussion.
I just have a question about the goal. So the real goal is to educate all the frontline people and really get down to the teachers and the policemen, our different folks that are interacting, and then also get those who have experienced trauma and recognize that in a way. Is that fair assessment?
That's a portion of it. I think it always has to be viewed that is only done in the context of a larger systems change. We can't put all on the backs of our frontline workers and expect them to be able to carry the trauma-informed principles and practice to their clients. It really is part of how we do business.
It really does kind of make you more compassionate, though, rather than asking to do something. It's like, what happened to you?
Right.
You do this?
Yeah.
Not give anybody excuses. I guess my one caution is, and I think this committee especially has been sensitive to this, but as you create a center, make sure you decentralize your processes. Otherwise, you're going to have this beautiful center and you can get people together and talk about an issue, but unless we get it down.
Yeah.
I think that was, you know, part of what you tried to do or were trying to do by having the counties in the state.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my one.
Absolutely agree that we need this at the local level. And it can't just be a top down or it never works.
Yeah.
Can we count on the private sector and your colleagues on the board? And,
yes, I got together with Scott Anderson as soon as we saw the film, and we won't let it go.
Okay.
We won't let this go.
Thank you.
Private sector will not.
Again, I believe we work best as a state when it's us working together. And that's because you guys can do some things that we can't and vice versa, and that's very helpful. So, then I would look for a motion to support moving forward with the creation for a center for
appreciate your time.
I'd be happy to make that motion.
Thank you.
Second.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, thank you. We will.
Thank you.
We'll get back to you. We'll see who needs to be on that group. We'll convene and start the process.
Great. Okay. Wonderful.
Thank you. Okay, we are rapidly running out of time, but I would like Nate to join us. Thank you. Welcome. We're so excited to have you here with us. Do you mind just introducing yourself?
Nate Asperis, the Juvenile Court Administrator, about 8 months in.
Congratulations. We're excited to have you. Thank you. Anything else that needs to be discussed? All right. I would look for a motion to adjourn.